you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. You know, it's been really the theme of the midterm elections since, I don't know, I guess since the beginning of the summer, reproductive rights, abortion politics. And there is, you know, there's been a consensus for the last couple months that, we don't know the outcome of the election, but there's no question that when the Dobbs decision was released in, I guess it was it late June, but was obviously previewed about 6 weeks earlier when basically the same opinion was leaked in early May, that the politics of abortion fundamentally redirected the trajectory of this year's election. There's no question about that. What the final result is, that's still up for debate. We don't know. But there's no question about that. So yesterday, or actually, I guess, night before yesterday, so Monday night, everyone, and I won't speak for other people, myself, I was sort of dumbfounded when I heard that Lindsey Graham was going to introduce a bill to have a national abortion ban on abortions after 15 weeks. Now, that's basically what was sort of like wild and controversial from Mississippi last year, right? That's the bill that is the standard that brought down Roe v. Wade. Right. So that was considered like really draconian and blah, 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 blah. And again, there's been this sort of, it's just kind of widely assumed, everybody's kind of taken for granted, that Republicans are facing a big backlash over Dobbs. People are upset. You know, you look at polls and they show usually at least 60% of the population supports Roe. Doesn't want to, you know, didn't want to see Roe overturned. Often for Roe overturned, it's even higher. It gets up to like 70%. There's different ways you ask the question. If you say like, are you pro-choice? Now you're often getting in the mid-50s, higher 50s on that question, which is much higher than it was even a few years ago. Question changes a little if you say, you know, do you support overturning Roe? It goes higher. But in any case, it's between like, it's overwhelmingly unpopular, Dobbs, depending on how exactly you look at it. And Republicans are doing their best to run away from it. I mean, there's only so much they can run. It's their issue. They did it, right? I mean, you kind of like you're standing over the body with a knife, right? There's only so much you can do. But even politicians who were like hardcore anti-abortion, you know, supporting fetal personhood laws. Even you've seen some of them kind of take down the parts of their site that talk about abortion, which is, you know, I said like you can only do so much. Well, that's actually even more than you can do, right? Because it just attracts attention. Like what? Like is that like that's done? You've changed your mind. So and what Democrats are trying to do now, and to me, they're trying to do it because it's true. They're trying to say, don't think it stops here. The next time that Republicans are in control of the federal government, they will move on from allowing states to ban abortions or to ban it nationally. Maybe the Supreme Court will get in on the act and ban abortion. through some sort of, you know, on the margins now, but the idea that you kind of decide judicially that a fetus is a life and under the 14th Amendment, you can't abort it. Things move very quickly these days from like kind of fringe bizarre ideas to like law of the land. So Democrats, I think both because it is true, but also because there are obvious political advantages, want to say, you got to keep us in control of the Senate, control of the Congress, because you in California, you in New York, you in Pennsylvania and Washington State and Illinois, you know, you think none of this applies to you. Well, in fact, they're going to ban it nationwide. So Republicans don't want to talk about that. Oh, we're never going to do that, or just whatever. So like, what is Lindsey Graham coming forward and say, hey, you know what? I want to kind of diffuse this issue that has gotten everyone. I'm going to diffuse it by introducing a national abortion ban. Now, it's true that it's not an absolute ban from like day one. It's 15 weeks. And I think one of the forever perplexities of the abortion debate is that, I don't want to say most people, because there's pretty big differences between people, right? Maybe it's most men, but the public debates about abortion are often carried on with very little grounding in what actually happens with abortion. Like something like 90 or 95% of abortions happen within the first 13 weeks. Overwhelmingly, they're very early for obvious reasons. You know, if you have an unplanned pregnancy and you don't want to be pregnant, it takes you a certain amount of time to find out you're pregnant, you know, can depend. And then maybe you need, you know, you don't need 10 weeks to whatever. Overwhelmingly happens early. Okay. Except for the cases that there are certain, all sorts of reasons. And again, it's like maybe 5% that are after that date. And we all know the reasons why those happen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So why is he doing this? And as this was announced, you know, kind of previewed Monday night, people were kind of like, this is what's the 11-dimensional chess? What does Lindsey Graham have up his sleeve? What is Mitch McConnell? What diabolical plan is he about to flip the abortion politics on Democrats and change everything? Now, one thing that people thought, and I think is true as far as it goes, is that for years, and it's one of the ways that Republicans sort of fooled themselves into thinking that it's a pro-life country, it's the country's divided, you know, 50-50 on abortion, was to say, to not talk about abortions where the overwhelming majority, almost all of them happen, but to get into these hypotheticals often tendentiously described, like, okay, yeah, maybe you get an abortion like right when you find it, but what about the evil women who like they're 2 weeks away from getting birth and they get a great plane fare to Hawaii and suddenly they're having an abortion? We can all agree that that's not right. Late term abortion, to kind of put it there. And again, since abortion public debates are seldom carried out with like a real grounding of why things happen. But that is something when you talk about partial birth abortion and late term abortion, that's where the public gets a lot more squeamish and a lot more, I don't know if I like that. Or maybe if you're doing that, maybe you're just a frivolous woman who's having an abortion for no reason or something like that. It's worked for them politically. That's why we hear again, partial birth abortion, this late term, blah, 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 blah. So that was maybe the thinking about the diabolical plan. That they're gonna say, okay, well, we're not saying you can't, you know, the vast majority. We're just gonna ban the kind of the really, really bad stuff late in the pregnancy. And again, that's worked for them in the past. I think in some ways, the public politics of abortion have changed just dramatically in the sense that I don't think it will work the same way anymore, because it worked one way when it was all hypothetical. Like, sure, you can talk about banning this or banning that, but the Supreme Court has it bottled up, so you can't really do anything. So Republicans could just sort of play the politics of it when it was all theoretical. Now it's not theoretical. there are large portions, certainly most of the territory of the United States, if not the people, abortion's already banned. It's already done, right? Because of Dobbs. So it's very real. But in any case, it didn't even really fit that model. Because first of all, it's 15 weeks, which Kate and I were just talking about. That's what that Mississippi bill that brought down Roe did, a ban at 15 weeks. So it's not really late term abortion by even in the tendentious ways that Republicans have talked about it in the past. It's really early. The second thing is, it's not like setting some national standard. It's not like they're coming in and saying, "Oh, okay, hey, states got out of hand. They were banning abortion. That's not allowed. That we can't, you know, that's not okay. We're just going to kind of say you can have your abortions, but not after 15 weeks." But that's not what it's saying. It's saying it remains banned in all red states, with, you know, Kansas is like an exception, maybe one or two others. And this just partially bans it in blue states. So it's really a blue state ban. And then the third thing is, you can talk about 15 or this or that or the other, but there's some salient words. National abortion ban. National abortion ban. Whatever details you want to fit into that, that is going to the next level. Is it going to be left to the states? Well, in fact, it will not be left to the states, because only like a month or two after the fact, Republicans are already wanting to ban it nationwide. Yes, they'll allow it in some circumstances, blah, 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 blah. So everybody's thinking like, what is the secret diabolical plan? Because clearly Republicans are doing it. So there must be a secret diabolical plan. Well, by the next day, it was sort of clear that many of Graham's colleagues were like, "Dude, what the fuck are you doing? Are you insane? We're trying to get out of under this backlash against Dobbs. We want to talk about inflation. We want to talk about Sleepy Joe and all that kind of stuff. You're like putting abortion even more at the center stage." So it was clear that at least the players in the Republican Senate caucus, who care a lot about being in the leadership and care a lot about winning elections, were sort of like, "You got to be kidding. Like, who put you up to this? What is going on?" I did notice just before we started recording, this guy Bud, whose name escapes me, I'm sure Kate will know it, the Republican candidate for Senate in North Carolina, he is co-sponsoring it in the House. I think I have this right. He's now in the House. He's running. He's looking for the promotion up to the Senate. He wants to co-sponsor Graham's thing in the House. And a lot of Democrats are like, "Yeah, dude, by all means, I co-sponsor it right now. Let's vote." And, you know, one thing, and we're going to talk about this, is it's this very basic question now. Chuck Schumer can schedule the vote. And why not? Why not? The Republicans, who aren't complete idiots, do not want to vote on this right now. And that something like that may even happen in the House. So anyway, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a few other issues that are happening in the news. But before I introduce my co-host, let me remind you that Josh Marshall Podcast, brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. If you can't handle the heat, get back to the kitchen, because with a glass of Grady's New Orleans style cold brew in your hand, you'll be ready to tackle whatever sweaty situations pop up this summer. If your previous attempts at cold brewing were messy, bitter, or bland, don't worry. Grady's makes cold brewing consistent, easy, and mess-free. Their beanbag cold brew kit provides everything you need to make the perfect cup of iced coffee at home. And there's no need to buy any special coffee gadgets. You can brew right inside Grady's store and pour pouch and enjoy tasty iced coffee all summer long. Summer-proof your fridge today at Grady'sColdBrew.com. You just use the promo code TPM. That great acronym that is the emblem of our organization. Use the promo code TPM to save 25% off at Grady'sColdBrew.com. Okay, co-host Kate Riga, I don't know if you were physically up at the Hill yesterday after this happened, but you were talking to people and following this. So what's the deal? What happened? What was Graham thinking? And what were his colleagues thinking after they heard what he was doing?
Yeah, so I think to start, I want to do just a bit of a fact check, a ginormous fact check, because for anyone who watched the Graham presser yesterday or kind of saw snippets of it, it was just like a perfect encapsulation of all of the lies that the anti-abortion movement has been kind of pumping out for years, almost with kind of no retribution, because a lot of mainstream journalism outlets are so hell-bent on not, quote, choosing sides on the abortion debate that so much of this just goes completely unchecked and has like made its way into the mind of all kinds of people, even people who are not really diehards on the abortion thing. So to start with, this bill is called the, quote, Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from the Late-Term Abortions Act. Okay. It's almost impressive that in one phrase, he managed to kind of cram so much stuff that isn't true. But first, the pain capable piece, this is a huge thing in abortion circles. And it makes sense, right? It has emotional resonance. The idea that if you are aborting an embryo or a fetus, it can feel it and it can feel pain. So they use that a lot. The scientific consensus is that fetuses cannot feel pain until the third semester. Evidence seems to suggest quite late in the third semester. And this is trimester. And this is just due to you need to build up the structures that enable you to feel pain and enable your body to communicate that to your brain. And that takes a while. So without a doubt, at 15 weeks, a fetus cannot feel pain. That's just not true. Then it says late-term abortions, which you got into a little bit in the intro, Josh, but late-term abortion is not a medical term. That is straight from the anti-abortion movement. In medical terms, late term in the pregnancy refers to after 40 weeks of pregnancy. That's used to describe births that kind of come after the average of when most women are giving birth.
Like, so basically after the due date.
Exactly. So there's no such thing as a late term abortion. And if there was, 15 weeks is fairly early in the second trimester. So it's not even late in terms of, you know, the progress of a pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of descriptive math, there's three trimesters. Maybe by, again, in some non-medical sense, you could say the third trimester is late because it's not first and second, it's third. But certainly 15 weeks cannot be late just by any stretch of the imagination.
You know, and as you say, per CDC data for 2019, which is the last we have of the big abortion survey data, 93% of abortions happen 13 weeks or under. So another big part of this press briefing was Graham just kept being like, thousands and thousands and thousands of abortions happen. You know, it's just, this is an anomaly. Having an abortion at this point is an anomaly. And most of them that are late for reasons that are kind of unrelated to fetal anomalies or something else kind of going medically wrong is due to a lack of sex education. You see this a lot with, you know, especially younger women. And state enforced restrictions that make it harder to get an abortion that entail travel and overbooked clinics because a lot of them have been shuttered. So, you know, Graham was kind of standing there with this phalanx of, you know, quote unquote, pro-life, anti-abortion women around him, kind of being like, you know, and this isn't all we want, but this is a compromise. This is reasonable. And there was a lot of the, this is just bringing us into the standard that our European brothers and sisters live by, which again, simply not true, because with the exception of a country like Poland, which is like a big outlier, most European countries, abortion is way more accessible. Usually it's subsidized. And even though there are gestational bans in some countries, they have much more liberal exceptions, like, you know, a mother not having, or the woman not having financial means to raise the child, or mental health, all the kind of stuff that by comparison, US bans do not have and are much more draconian. So it's just not, you know, it's totally an apples and oranges situation.
My understanding, you know, one of the arguments that people make who push back against the argument that he's making is that, you know, in huge amounts of the country, no one is providing abortions in driving distance. And by driving distance, I mean normal driving distance, like an hour, something like that. I don't mean like driving 10 hours or sometimes not even that. So the point being, if it's the kind of thing where almost literally you could go to the local WebMD down the street, that the need to not have these cutoffs is less great. Anyway, it's a point we've dealt with.
Right. I mean, and as you also said, you know, this it should, if this bill passed, it wouldn't supersede state laws, which means that any state that wanted to ban abortion still could. So as you say, this would largely just be an imposition on blue states whose inhabitants don't want to have abortion restrictions. So the whole thing, they just, you know, the framing of it as this middle of the road, everyone can agree, compromise, is just bullshit to begin with, because this isn't a moderate abortion policy. And I guarantee if someone brought up, you know, what the French have and we're like, let's have this here as he professes to want, Republicans would be like, whoa, 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 that's way too liberal, you know? So that's, you know, none of this is kind of forthcoming. They were just spewing lies left, right, and sideways. I mean, provable lies. And just, it boggles me because you watch this press conference and no one asks them about it. Like, no one fact checks it, you know? But we've entered this weird zone on abortion where the intent to always be quote unquote neutral and to report neutrally on the controversial question of abortion means that so many journalists now just feel like they can't fact check the blatantly false things that the anti-abortion movement says to make abortion seem, you know, more barbaric or more harmful for women and more of an outlier in the world.
Well, the other thing, I mean, it's you know, kind of what amounts to compromise is always highly subjective. But a few weeks ago, the grand compromise was, we're going to leave it to the states.
Right.
Massachusetts has one political culture. They want one thing. Oklahoma has another. Everyone can be happy. Now, we know that there's turns out to be a little more complicated than that on a number of grounds. But like, I thought that was the grand compromise and the moderate middle ground. Now, the moderate middle ground is the states that want to ban abortion can ban abortion. And the states that want to have abortion, the federal government bans it for them. Like, okay.
Share to everyone, right?
Yeah, that doesn't, I missed something. So, and it's funny, you know, again, in that half a dozen hours when everybody's trying to figure out what the secret plan was, I saw some people saying, well, what they're going to probably do is say now that kind of like abortion is legal across the country, up until 15 weeks. And then after it's not. And I said to some of these people, like, what country do you live in? Do you think that there is any way that the Republican Party could, like, oh, we've been working for 50 years to get Dobbs, but now that we've fallen 3 points on the congressional generic ballot, we are now going to make it permanently legal to have abortions up to 15. I mean, are you kidding? So of course not. It's just, yeah. Here's the thing though. Why do we think he did this?
I mean, just, you know, real quick before we get into the political side, which is super fascinating and a rich text, I think, is just that we've said this on the show before, but it's just, you have to keep it in your mind when you're thinking about abortion, which is there is a small, very vocal minority in the Republican Party that deeply, deeply believes that abortion is murder, that it is a heinous act, that it is, you know, killing the most innocent of society. And the party is very beholden to that minority of people. And the idea that that minority of people would be like, well, there are fewer murders now, so, you know, job well done. I mean, that's where the activism comes from. So this idea of like, well, they'll settle for a compromise. I mean, these people don't see this as an issue you can compromise on. That's why it, for, you know, a kind of an astonishingly large number of people, is their single issue. It's what they base their entire political identity on. So yeah, the idea of like stopping at 15 weeks versus the reality, which is going to be get rid of abortion altogether, and then we can move on to birth control, right? Like, that's the much more realistic state of affairs.
And it's also, I mean, it's always a question of what people really believe that you can, to a certain degree, infer from their actions. And that is, I mean, it is actually only a minority of even pro-life voters. If you really believe that every abortion is taking a small version of a baby, but a baby in every meaningful sense, and killing it, and it's happening every day, not everywhere in the country, but, you know, it's happening, and it's you know, that's a hair on fire thing if you believe that. And it's even the kind of thing where some people say, like, oh, it's killing, but, well, you know, incest, rape. If you really believe it is killing, it's fully equal to taking a young child and just like cutting its head off, even things like, you know, but some people believe that. And as you say, that is kind of the Republican Party is in hock to that world. And obviously you've got lots of people who just don't like it, think it's not killing, but it's wrong, or, you know, empowers the sluts.
Exactly.
If you have abortions, right? I mean,
huge unspoken part of this is yes, it gives you license to exactly. police women's sexuality.
Yes. And these things all flow together. But in any case, there is simply no way that this is like the, you know, you've been the golden prize after half a century of activism. And that's why I think, you know, for lots of why the right is relatively low energy now on this issue, they won. Yeah, there's more stuff they want to do. But man, take a breather. Even working so hard, you know, they think they won, and they won in a way that it cannot be taken back.
Right. Well, I mean, and look at the kind of quote unquote compromise, the way that the party was already moderating itself was this idea of, like you say, leave it to the states. That's the Democratic way to do it, isn't it? You know, let's not talk about the states that are gerrymandered past the point of no return, but that's the way to do it. Put the power back in the people's hands. We saw that that was not really assuaging the situation for Republicans. I mean, we don't have a ton of data points in Stobbs, but we've got Kansas. We've got a handful of special elections in bellwether districts where the Democrats ran hard on abortion. I mean, we have early signifiers that the Democratic base is very energized in a way that they weren't pre-Dobbs, right? So we already know that the kind of leave it to the states thing was not really a perfect band-aid for this situation. And then out comes Lindsey Graham sauntering out saying, pulling the rug out from under that, saying that wasn't true. We actually are going to do a national abortion ban. And, you know, you and I have been talking about this offline. We've been kind of puzzling it out to see how did he misjudge this so badly? Like, was it just a situation where he thought the 15-week would get more attention than the national abortion ban part of the phrase? I mean, if that is the case, then he's off his rocker, because a through line in the abortion debate since the beginning of time has been for how many people give birth in this country, people have absolutely no freaking idea what like the week structure, what the trimester structure indicates. People just don't know. So the fact that, you know, maybe he thought 15 weeks would be this really moderating force. Like, you can ask anyone off the street, and I'm telling you, people would have an appalling lack of information about what 15 weeks even means in the grand scheme of a pregnancy.
No, it is, you know, I think a certain percentage of people would even struggle to say how many months that is, right? Let alone like a pregnancy. The other weird thing is, and again, I just can't make sense of it. I guess he had actually introduced a version of this bill in the last couple Congresses, but people introduce all sorts of stuff as just a kind of, you know, there's some group that wants, you know, some activist group that wants it, and they kind of, you know, just like putting like a stamp on something. It's not a hard thing to do, but like, there's no, I have been watching Lindsey Graham for 25 years in office. Abortion's not his issue. He's pro-life, but you know, his issues are like judges, foreign policy is a big issue for him, talking on Meet the Press is a big issue for him. But like, he's not like a big abortion dude. So I even want to like, there are a lot of other people in Congress, in the Senate, who I would have said, oh, they're going to go to this guy, or this guy would do it, or something like that. And the other thing is, if like, you know, if one of those kind of like rando senators who represent 9 people from like Wyoming or Idaho or something like that, that would be one thing. Or if you had like even like a Ted Cruz, who everybody knows who Ted Cruz, you know, everybody who's even loosely following politics knows who Ted Cruz is, then people could say, all right, whatever, you know, Ted Cruz always doing something stupid, blah, 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 blah. There are few people who are more associated with the leadership of the Republican Party in DC, in the Senate, than Lindsey Graham. Like after like Mitch McConnell, even though he's not part of the leadership, and some of that is just because he's got this kind of, you know, he's Joe Meet the Press. He's all, you know, he's just constantly present in the press. He's Lindsey Graham. That when he says that, Democrats can now say, oh, man, Republicans now pushing for a national abortion ban. And even though that at least the leadership has kind of like, dude, knock it the fuck off, that's the Republican Party. He speaks for the Republican Party. He really does. In a way that, again, some rando in the Senate, you would have just been saying like, okay, you're saying that, but just they can't help but one random dude does.
I mean, that's a weird part of it, because not that Graham is not self-aggrandizing, and he, you know, like when I was at the Ketanji Brown Jackson hearings, he was one of those up with Cruz and Hawley who used his minutes to kind of throw a tantrum and do a little, everyone watch me, I'm going to get a clip out of this thing. You know, it's not like that's beyond him. But I think what's weird about this, in line with what you're saying, is that he's kind of a get along guy. Like, I think he likes this. He likes the camaraderie of the Senate. I think he likes kind of being pals with people. And so the fact that, like you said, this is such a Ted Cruz move to like do something by yourself and be like, well, that's my conviction. That's my earnest conviction. You know, deal with it. Like, that's just not Graham to kind of go out on the branch by himself and have Mitch McConnell be pissed at him afterwards. And to also do a move like this that's so lacking in calculation, re the kind of general party's positioning on this issue. It just seems so strange that it came from him, as you say, instead of maybe a Cruz or a Hawley who's kind of me above everyone, you know, and willing to be performative to that end, or someone like, I don't know, a James Lankford who like has been near tears on the floor of the Senate with like blown up pictures of stock babies talking about this. And Graham just doesn't really fit either of those camps very neatly.
Not at all. And he's also just in a more in this, you alluded to this. I cannot think of the last time that the leadership in the Senate wants one thing and Graham's like, yeah, fuck it, man. I'm carrying this ball. And if it blows up things for you, that's just too bad, because I believe this strong. No way. He's tight with the leadership. He's, again, even though he's not formally, it's McConnell and Cornyn. And I don't even remember. I guess Thune is the whip.
Yeah.
He's a leadership guy. He's a team player with the leadership. Again, he is in essence part of the leadership, basically. So yeah, inexplicable on every front.
And the backlash, or I guess rather the Democrats kind of making hay of it, just started immediately. Like, you know, I saw in particular Fetterman had an email blast out about the new national abortion ban, like within hours, if not minutes, of it coming out. Maggie Hassan has her first kind of general election ad out now that we know who her opponent is going to be. And that was, you know, Dawn Bell Duke will be a yes on the national abortion ban. I mean, it's just like immediate. It's just a gift. I mean, he ended his press conference by saying, you know, when we win the House and the Senate, we're absolutely going to pass this bill. And it's like, you don't even have to hire an ad company. Chop, chop. There's your ad.
Yeah, it really is inexplicable. And again, it is true. When the Republicans are in power again, they are going to do this. That's not hyperbole. They are going to do it. However, when you are trying to inject that into this election cycle, you will have commentators and reporters with some element of accuracy saying, look, it's not going to happen. You know, they could win in a massive landslide. Joe Biden is still president. He's going to veto it. So there's no way anything like this is going to happen until 2025. And for it to happen, they've got to win both chambers. They have to win the presidency, and they have to have all of their majorities lined up, you know, for like jumping off Niagara Falls, basically.
And they have to have at least 60 seats in the Senate.
Yeah, well, you know.
Unless they got rid of the filibuster.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of these things where, you know, everybody talks about whenever McConnell wants, he'll torch the filibuster, and he will. But this is the one case where I think he might well say, like, hey, I'm a filibuster man. I'd love to be
these
passing
rules,
your national
baby.
Yeah, exactly. So they can say like, hey, it's not coming in the next Congress. It's at least the Congress after that. But here you have Lindsey Graham. As you said, he cut the ad just because he loves Democrats so much. if we win the House and the Senate, we're passing the national abortion ban. Like, okay, dude, like, let's just, like, every Democrat just runs that. I mean, it's sort of like we've been trying so hard to get these idiot Senate Democrats to get off to you know, not be idiots and do this 48 senator pledge, which they still haven't done yet. Like, what the fuck? It's so stupid. It's such a missed opportunity. But Lindsey Graham apparently trying to help, trying to do something similar from the other side, right? But that is the clarifying thing that everybody should realize: there will be national abortion legislation. It's just a question of who does it.
Right. I mean, so that is just the crux of the weirdest thing about this. Like, I know people quibble with the term messaging bill, but that's what this is. Right now, for the next few years, it's a messaging bill. There's no way that it's going to pass while Joe Biden is president, at the very least, you know? So it's just that you decide to unveil this particular messaging ban, what, a month and a half out from the midterms, when now you know you've got colleagues who are running in states where they can't endorse a complete abortion ban, you know, thinking like Ron Johnson, for one. And so it's just kind of a heaping plate of, let me screw over everyone in my party to no discernible gain for myself, except for, I guess, having some anti-abortion activists like him, which they, I would assume, already did.
Yeah, it's really it's inexplicable.
So another thing we wanted to talk about is that there's been kind of a flurry of stories that are being panic shared around, you know, left-leaning Twitter that basically all say, watch out, these great polls that are coming out for Democrats in the key Senate races. We're talking, you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that these are the same areas that have been overly optimistic for Democratic chances a lot in recent years, you know, 2016, 2020, particularly. 2018 is kind of the outlier, which we'll get into. But all the stories have been like, you know, be wary, because if the pollsters haven't fixed this recurring issue, then it very well could be happening again right now. And then I saw the New York Times did this, kind of readjusted it, took the averages as they are, did another column of like incorporating the biases from 2020 polls. And then this is how things really look right now. And I don't know how it struck you, Josh, but to me, when I saw that final column with the adjustment for the old biases, I was kind of like, that kind of looks more right to me, or more where I would guess that these races are, because we've been seeing some, like, you know, big Democratic, you know, plus fives in like Ohio, which I know Tim Ryan's a good candidate, but this is right. Ohio we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's, there's so many different moving parts to this. And I think we have to start with the fact that there has been a recurrent pattern, basically during the Trump era, going back to 2016, 18, 20, in which polls have, in general, slightly underestimated Republican strength, in general. In certain states, it's been more than slight. It's been significant. And the states where it has been the greatest are generally kind of Midwestern Rust Belt states. And the general assumption there is, you know, that's where you have, you know, kind of a lot of white working class voters that are sort of the Trump base. And you're missing, you're missing the Trump base. And that's why this is happening. Now, another aspect of that is that we kind of take it for granted today that education levels are a central demographic dividing line in our politics. Didn't always used to be the case at all, right? And that perhaps education levels, that polling has been less able to get to people with less educational attainment than people with more educational attainment. But since that wasn't a big dividing line in the old days, it kind of didn't matter. It didn't skew the polls. So that is a thing, and that has happened. And I think it is something that Democrats really need to take seriously. And that is why when I see averages that have, like, you know, Tim Ryan, who I love, who I think is the perfect candidate for Ohio right now for the Democrats, and I think has a real chance to win. When I see a poll average that has him like 2 percentage points up, I basically totally discount that. Like, that is, I consider that in a state like Ohio, I really assume that a Republican is going to overperform an average of that magnitude. And another thing about that race is that both candidates have been relatively low, and that tells me something different. If you have the two candidates and they're both like in the low 40s. But Tim Ryan is up by a couple points. Well, that leaves a lot of people out there undecided. And it's a Republican state. It increasingly is a Republican state. So that's plenty of room for that partisan muscle memory to kind of kick in at the last minute. Now, other states that have been like that, Wisconsin has been like that a lot. Pennsylvania has been like that a lot. Michigan has been like that a lot. So now, on the other hand, there are states like Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, where Democrats have overperformed the polls with some consistency. Not always, but it's not the same everywhere. And in the Senate, obviously, those kind of things make a big difference. Now, there are take Pennsylvania, John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz. Fetterman is way up, way up. I think he's up more than enough that even if there's a skew, he's still going to win. So I'm pretty confident there. I think there's another Wisconsin poll coming out, Barnes versus Johnson. We'll see what that one was. There was one like a few weeks ago that had him up like 7 points over Ron Johnson. You know, Wisconsin has just been like a killing field for Democratic dreams in recent cycles. And the one thing that the sort of the smart poll skeptics, I don't mean polls in general, but the ones who make these arguments point out is that, you know, Joe Biden won Wisconsin, but not by nearly as much as the poll said he would. He just squeaked by. Whereas I think the poll averages had him winning by a decent margin. So this is real. It's also not the case, though, that every cycle is the same. Things change. There was, a number of years ago, it was Democrats that were fairly consistently being underestimated, you know, not by time, but by small but significant amounts. We also have this run of special elections. You know, most elections before November are primaries. We have a few special elections that are partisan elections, and Democrats have consistently, I think in all of those, overperformed Biden, overperformed the polls. So that's different. That at least gives you a sense, okay, something's different this cycle. The Democrats are actually overperforming the polls. Now, the contrary argument is these are very low turnout races in sort of random parts of the country. A low turnout election, arguably, Democrats' motivation advantage is going to show up. A lot of white people with, you know, college degrees and master's degrees and JDs, you know, really spun up about Dobbs, and they're all showing up. So there are contrary reasons, but there's also reasons to think maybe it's not going to be a replay. And then as you said, Kate, it's 2018. That's the actual midterm. Right. So that's kind of an apples to apples. And as again, these skeptics point out, the skew was there too in 2018, but it wasn't nearly as much. It was not nearly as much. It's Democrats should definitely keep it in mind. I don't know what else, you know, how else to put it.
It's funny because I did kind of a big story on this post 2018 on just like what's going on with the polls, you know, and talk to some, you know, like G. Elliott Morris, just kind of some of those guys. And the theories were really interesting, you know, because you had after 2018, a lot of people were thinking that this kind of only happens when Trump's on the ballot. This like weird polling miss where, you know, they call it the silent Trump voter is like missed. And then there are all these flurry of explanations that maybe these people just have very low institutional trust. So they're not going to talk to a pollster and they're not going to stay on the phone. Whereas Democrats who, you know, lean less in that direction might be more willing to talk. And as you say, education was a big thing. That education had not been weighted that heavily before it became such the selector of the two parties. And then when we entered pandemic time, there started being thinking that, well, Democrats tend to be more cautious. They're sitting at home where they can answer calls from pollsters, and Republicans are out, you know, being maskless. And so we had just this flurry of theories. And I really still don't think, I mean, based on these pieces that we read before the pod, you know, no one really kind of said, well, here's the thing that is the reason that it keeps making the polls screwy. And that's why people should be worried. The thesis of them was just, these are the same states that have been wrong a lot recently. So Democrats should not be feeling kind of too high on themselves based on what we've seen before.
Yeah. And I think stated as such, yeah. Yeah, Democrats should be cautious, you know, and you always want to sort of assume you're running behind. And it's, you know, the best argument against this sort of chronic polling failure theory is the, like, what do you got? A data set of three. That's not a lot, right? And you did have, when Trump was not on the ballot, it changed significantly. You mentioned the pandemic. Obviously, that could be affecting the polling. It could also be affecting the voting, right? In isolation, a massive pandemic. Very hard to know what, you know, how did all the different things that kind of upended? What did, in any normal case where you had a lot of data, you'd throw out 2020. Because it's so weird. It's so, so weird. So who knows? But look, it's happened a few times. You can't just say like, oh, it happened and it was just a fluke. Well, it seems a little more than a fluke. But I will say, again, one other point. Democrats outdid the polls in Georgia in 2020. They, I believe, outdid the polls two of those cycles in Arizona. So even though a lot of these key races are in those kind of Democrat heartbreak states, not all of them. Not all of them. So hard to know.
Yeah, it is funny. And watch me do this segue, which is that, you know, as I've been writing about these races and using kind of what scant polling there are in the states, or there is in the states, it's just, it's not good. And we're, you know, especially primary polling is like notoriously even worse because limited money, right? So why would you kind of survey the field before you're at the main event? So we have very few of them. And it's at a time where lots and lots of people are not paying attention yet and don't know the candidates well yet. And there haven't been kind of barrages of TV and online ad assaults yet.
You mean in those special elections?
Both the special elections, yeah. And kind of even the banner races, just in their primary phases. Because at first I was thinking, you know, the Alaska polls, which were just the unholy trinity of Alaska is impossible to poll in general. This is a special election, so there's hardly any of it happening. And they're using a new voting system, ranked choice, for the first time. So, but it's funny because those all kind of showed that Palin didn't really have a shot, that the other Republican, Bakage, was probably going to beat her. And that ended up not at all being the case. But, and here's my segue, they also showed Don Baldock doubling Chuck Morse in New Hampshire, who were competing for the Republican Senate nomination there. And ballots are still being counted. I don't think AP has still even called the race, but it was rather close. Baldock won. Morse has already conceded, but I have looked from what polls were done, which were, I would say, like three or four kind of towards the tail end before the election. I was like, it was going to be a landslide.
And it wasn't.
That was not the case. Networks have still not called it.
What, like, roughly what's the percentage now?
When I checked this morning, it was like within 2 points of each other.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that I didn't realize it was that. I think what happened is, you know, sometimes when the polls close, they'll show results and it'll be like, you know, of one precinct. So it's 100 votes. Right. And I think when I saw that, I knew what the polls predicted. And then when I saw that, it was Balduke, like, you know, 55% and the next guy 20%. And I know that does, but that kind of stuck in my mind. So I didn't, and I knew he won because I saw the reports that he, you know, seems like he's won, but I didn't realize it was that close. Yeah. The one thing I will say about the special elections, you know, a lot of these special elections weren't even polled at all because, you know, no one really cares or has an interest in running the poll. But the thing that has jumped out to people is that these candidates are running ahead of Biden, that being a key thing. So there's what, you know, kind of the, you think about, that's the sort of, that is the actual Democratic Party, the people who turn out to show up for the, you know, for the president, for the top of the ticket. And if that percentage is getting better in the midterm, well, you look at that as a campaign analyst and you say, okay, that's very different from what we'd expect.
Right.
You expect you're going to get a drop off. So,
mm-hmm.
Low turnout, blah, you know.
Yeah. Quick update here. AP has called the race, but their percentages, Balduke is at 37, Morse is at 35.8. So that ended up being quite tight. But yeah, I totally agree with you on the special election. And also, I think it's important to kind of keep an eye on Biden's favorability ratings, because I do think there's, even if, you know, where he's at now, I don't think Democrats would like throw a parade about, you know, he's still not great, but there's been quite a lift from where he was. And I think that's important because there is a threshold where I think people can kind of run ahead of him and it'll be okay. And he's not really on the ticket himself, whatever. But I think there's a level where it's hard, even if you're a really good Democratic candidate, to kind of, you know, whatever the opposite of coattails are, to get away from that drag.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's funny right now, on Nate Silver's site, it has the average as 42.4 by really most standards. That is not great. That is not a great by any means of imagination. It has gone up like 5 or 6 points over the last six, seven weeks, which is a dramatic rise very quickly. My sense was that he would keep rising dramatically till about 45. It seems like he's kind of at least plateaued a bit for now, a little over, you know, between 42 and 43. I think the big thing there is Democrats, you've got a lot of Democrats just pissed at him for not getting the job done. And they're flocking back because they were never against him as a Democrat. They just didn't think he was, you know, he wasn't delivering. I do think, you know, in these things become very meta and kind of semantic, but it's not just the number we see there. You know, now if you're, let's assume for the sake of conversation, which I broadly do, that is an accurate measure of the national public's sense of him. Even if he is unpopular by that metric, if you are running for office, you can say, hey, are gas prices going down or are they going up? And everybody's going to say, they're going down. I mean, at a partisan, at a friendly thing, because they are going down. They've gone down a lot and it's quickly, and they seem to be continuing going down. And you say, did Joe Biden deliver the ridiculously named Inflation Reduction Act? Yes, he did. So it's not just his popularity. It's that a number of things have happened, some entirely in his control, some partially in his control, or he was just there, that has given people some, you know, given Democrats some footing saying we're going in the right direction. You know, you see like the Dark Brandon memes, right? That people, you think about how comical. I mean, Dark Brandon was something different 3 months ago. But how, you just didn't have anybody saying at the beginning of the summer, like, oh, he put the Biden magic on you and you are smoked. Sorry. Right. It just puts a little kind of skip in people's step. And it's hard if you're running. And they were doing surprisingly well when he was just totally in the toilet. But it's hard when the leader of your party is just. Kind of flatlining.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of bums everybody out.
Yeah. We want to do a couple of questions, but just to round off this section, you know, Don Balduke did win the primary. We talked about this briefly on another pod, but you know, that was a really clear-cut case of kind of this conspiratorial wingnut versus the sedate/boring establishment pick that was kind of boosted with this infusion of last minute panic money of like $4 million to kind of like try to get him to win from a person who's connected to Mitch McConnell, but didn't work. Trump ended up endorsing no one, which is like pretty interesting, I think.
Kind of sad for Paul Duke.
Yeah, I know.
What do you have to do?
So badly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now he won that. Honestly, this campaign has have got to be just like a sigh of relief after sigh of relief for the Hassan campaign. Because first it was Sununu's not going to run. Whew. You know, now she will probably win. And then it's like, now you're going up against a guy who is running on abolishing the 17th Amendment. Like, score. Okay, that one seems a bit more, you know, a bit more in hand for the Democrats than it could have been if some things had gone differently.
Right. Now, is there, I guess the idea is that the other guy, the guy that Paul Duke beat,
mm-hmm.
that
Moore.
He's a fairly normal guy, just that he doesn't really have a brand. He's not, you know, he doesn't, Sununu, obviously, like, you know, the family is just entitled in that state to own every office and they're super popular and all that kind of stuff. So unobjectionable, but just not someone who brought any star power, but not someone who's going to like, you know, you're going to, I don't know, you know, find out that they're Q or something like that.
Right. I mean, he did, you know, he did like some MAGA dabbling. He talked a lot about the border, which I think is kind of funny to be fixated on the southern border when you're running to represent New Hampshire. But yeah, just kind of low energy, right? He's just like a state lawmaker who's kind of sedate. And there was just this one quote he gave to the Washington Post where he was talking about he had had a phone call with Trump and Trump had asked him some questions. And Chuck Morse was just like, yeah, you know, he's got some strong opinions. And it's like, yeah, Chuck, he does. That's right. Just classic low energy understatement, you know.
So I guess the idea is with this Paul Duke guy, like she couldn't ask for better. A kind of a brandless nutcase. Like if she can't beat him, like she can't beat anybody, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So let's move to our questions. Our first is from Zach, which kind of loops back on our polling section. He says, do most/all polls correct their polling models based on their past performance? And if so, doesn't that make comparisons of polling bias from previous election from previous years fraught because the current polling has already corrected for the previous bias?
Not really. It's very complicated. After every cycle, pollsters, they analyze, they maybe, you know, work on their model, they adjust and whatever. And certainly after 2016, when there was a big miss in general, there was a lot of both soul searching and, you know, there are various academic and professional groups of pollsters that, like, you know, do symposiums and what went wrong and stuff like this. But the thing is that if your poll is 3 points off, you can't just say, oh, I'm just going to add 3 points next time and then I'll be on the mark. Well, you first of all, you can't do that since obviously you have no idea why your poll was 3 points off. It's highly likely just to be random chance that it was 3 points off. That's the first thing. The second thing is, since pollsters, the good pollsters, take what they do seriously, you have to do an analysis and say, ah, okay, the issue is that we didn't wait for education. And because of this thing about the changing electorate, education is now very salient. So whereas we used to, you know, weight by gender and marital status, now we have to add education. So we're going to change that. So, you know, you actually have a theory based on some evidence that leads you to do something. You can't just say like, oh, I keep being 3 points off. I'm just going to change it 3 points next time. That's just not how they do things. And I think that in Nate Cohen, the guy who the Nate from the New York Times had this piece, that he referenced that the sort of the polling professional organization did one of these sort of retrospective postmortems after 2020. And what he said in that article was that the upshot was basically they were not able to find a reason why they were off. Ergo, you kind of can't do anything, at least as a profession. I mean, any pollster can do whatever they want. And his point there was, ergo, so they're just going to repeat the same flaws that they did last time. You can't exactly assume that. But I guess the point is that pollsters have done a significant amount in the last few cycles to adjust for what seems to be a changing electorate. And I think most of that is waiting for education in ways that they did not do before, possibly being a little more sensitive to non-response bias. When one side gets terrible news, they're bummed and they're just not answering the phone. So you can get a big jump for the other side. That isn't really anybody's opinions changing. It's just some people are too bummed to answer the phone. So they have done that. And I think one of the kind of the wake up calls in 2020 was like, wow, we thought we'd nailed this. But something similar happened. Now, was that random chance? Was it just all the weirdness tied to the pandemic? We don't know. But I think the general thing is, it's not as easy to adjust as it might seem. So you can't necessarily assume that last time is irrelevant because they've already adjusted for it.
A recurring question I have about this that I have seen addressed nowhere is, like, who's picking up phone calls for random numbers at this stage in the game? Like, we don't live in a landline world anymore. And I don't know about you guys, but the number of spam calls I get a day is astronomical. So I wonder how that stuff is playing in.
Well, I at least know that they don't get identified as spam calls. You know, like in my phone, at least it says spam risk, right? So, okay, obviously not going to answer that. This has been a growing issue for forever. And I got polled, I think, once last cycle or something like that. But it is also, I mean, look, until about 10 years ago, it was only landline, not even just phone, landline. You know, my wife and I, we don't even have a landline anymore. I mean, I know a lot of young people haven't had one, maybe never have had one, but that was a sort of a big thing for us, getting rid of our landline. Non-response is a huge issue, but no pollster these days is doing only phones. They do texts, they do computer stuff, they do all sorts of stuff. And it's funny that it's not, the issue is not that there's been these misses. They can't be perfect. It's that there's been misses in one direction. That's the issue. And it's a real issue. And you can't just assume it'll be identical. But when these people say this, this isn't just kind of like, you know, saying Democrats are in disarray. There's some reality there that if you're a Democrat and you want Democrats to do well, you should feel a little haunted by that. Not demoralized, but like, you know, you may want to be a good 2 or 3 points ahead to have much confidence. Maybe it'll be different. Who knows?
It was the funniest thing. Like a year or two ago, my very sweet boyfriend got called by a pollster, but was like about to head into a work meeting. He was like, I got to go, but can I call you back? Like, I really want to participate, because he wanted to like do his civic duty. And I'm sure the pollster was like, wow, this is the first time today I haven't gotten like yelled at for calling people.
You know, maybe it was also in that Nate Cohen piece, but I actually saw that there was, maybe I'm thinking of a different article. I think he said that there were some pollsters that were downweighting eager Democrats, you know, basically like your boyfriend. Right. Of people who say like, yes, let me clear my schedule. I'm at dinner, but I'm going to tell them to eat on their own because I want to tell you how awesome Joe Biden is.
The pollster's right? Like, nope, get out of my poll.
Exactly. And then, you know, it is funny because The heart of Trumpism really is about low trust in civic institutions, a sense of grievance. So it is interesting how, and now that overlaps with education levels, but you can kind of, it is intuitive in a sense. If you think about the sort of the stereotypical Trumper, when he gets a call from a pollster, you're not thinking like, public opinion science. Yes, let me participate in this communal activity to know what we as a community think. No, of course not. Everything about the sort of the Trump mentality goes in the opposite direction. So it's not surprising that there would be, you know, that this would be an issue.
Right. Okay. So our last question is from Doug, who wants to know, say November brings the Senate to the Dems and the House barely to the Republicans, then presumably legislation to codify Roe and the John Lewis Voting Act would be dead for 2 years in the new session, yet there would still be almost 2 months of the current session left. Would the prospect of 2 years of crazy enough Republican House proposals be enough to get Sinema and Manchin to finally break the filibuster for those two huge legislative priorities?
I think the answer is just no. I can't imagine. Unfortunately, I think the answer is just no. Who knows? Maybe. I mean, hopefully. I can't imagine what would change. It's also like, it also kind of depends, like if the result is one where you say, wow, you know, they still lost the House, but Democrats, what a comeback, greatest comeback ever. Then maybe it is, you know, 0.5% versus 0%, right? But politicians, for whatever reason, are very, like, if the Democrats get demolished, there's no way that those two are going to be like, yep, no more filibuster. Let's get down to business here. That's not how anybody works. I think the answer is no.
I mean, yeah, no. I think that if those two pieces of legislation in particular were actually important to these two senators, then they would have already passed. You know, I don't think the prospect of a Republican takeover in Congress is not one that is foreign to them. And I don't think having the specter of that looming closer would kind of change their priorities, because those would be the actions of someone who either A, took those issues very seriously, or B, the future of the party was very important to them. And I just don't think that either of those are true for either of these senators. So I don't think the prospect of a Republican takeover is maybe even one that they are super concerned about. I mean, maybe to the degree that it makes them a little less important, but I'm sure they'll just start kind of, you know, hobnobbing with the Republicans to present themselves as, well, maybe we're the crossover votes when you guys get the House, you know? So yep. I don't see any situation where these two kind of change their stripes at this point in the game.
I completely agree. And I think the only time something like that would have happened would have been like in the month after the mini BBB passed, because suddenly everybody's excited. Everybody's friends again. Look what we can do. Elections have consequences. That was the time where you'd kind of say, like, you know what? Let's do it. But it didn't happen. So it's not going to happen.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. Seriously womping. I'm even self-womping, which is like against my religion. So anyway, I guess that's about it for us for this week. Remember that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off if you use the promo code TPM. And that's it.
All right. See you next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.